Before we jump into today's episode, we've got a free resource you won't want to miss. It's called The Robot Race: Could AI Ever Replace Humanity? A thought-provoking ebook exploring the rise of artificial intelligence, what it means to be human, and how Christians can think biblically in this new tech age. If you've ever asked, can machines become conscious? Or does AI challenge our faith? This is for you. Download your free copy now at premierinsight.org/resources. Again, that's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast. Before we jump into today's episode, we've got a free resource you won't want to miss. It's called The Robot Race: Could AI Ever Replace Humanity? A thought-provoking ebook exploring the rise of artificial intelligence, what it means to be human, and how Christians can think biblically in this new tech age. If you've ever asked, can machines become conscious? Or does AI challenge our faith? This is for you. Download your free copy now at premierinsight.org/resources. Again, that's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
Thank you for listening to the show that brings you the thought and theology of C.S. Lewis with me, Ruth Jackson. Discover more about Lewis by visiting premierunbelievable.com, where you can also find lots of great articles, resources, and podcasts. And you can also register there for the chance to win a free book. If you enjoy listening to the C.S. Lewis podcast, please do consider rating and reviewing it. But now for today's show.
I'm absolutely delighted to be joined today by Dr. Paul Anderson, a professor of biblical and Quaker studies at George Fox University in Oregon. He's the author of over 400 essays and the editor and author of over 30 books. And his new book that he's working on currently, Jesus in Johanan Perspective, Inviting a Fourth Quest for Jesus, will hopefully be out in 2026. So we're going to hear a little bit more about that. But Paul is also a founding member of the John Jesus and History Project. As well as finding out more about Paul's fascinating work, we're going to be hearing a paper that he presented at the 2024 Undiscovered C.S. Lewis Conference, which was held at George Fox University. And the title of Paul's paper there was On Fernseed, Elephants, Boltman and Lewis, Varied Expertise in Critical Perspective. Paul, for someone who's not read Fernseed and Elephants, this essay of Lewis's, would you just summarise the essay and give us a little bit of the context around it?
Yes. Well, Lewis wrote two editions of it. The first was in 1959, and he talks about sheep and that scholars are not writing for sheep. And as shepherds, they should be writing for sheep, not for shepherds. And so he says, as a sheep, saying I'm not a New Testament shepherd, I've got four bleats, four complaints. The first is that scholars, in claiming to read between the lines, are doing more of between the lines than the actual lines themselves. How is that for a critical operation? Read the lines first, take it as face value, and then deal with that, instead of assuming in an arrogant modernist way, we know more than they did, or we know more than their first followers did. So that's the first bleat. The second follows on that. Early Christians misunderstood Jesus, but we really know what he was getting at about the delay of the appearance, the parousia, or the second coming of Christ. Well, again, how do you know that? The third bleat is that we know in cause and effect modernism and building on Hume back in the day. Of course, you know, I mean, Hume in his essay on miracles, he was basically challenging the view that in the Eucharist, things become magically, chemically, the body and blood of Christ. And so he says, if it doesn't happen in nature, that's what a miracle is. But if you claim that it happened, then it's not a miracle. So Hume is basically dealing with the category of what is miraculous. Well, modern scholars, especially in Germany, cause and effect naturalism, again, sometimes they're too dogmatic as naturalists. So anything that appears wondrous, we know that it can't have happened. And so if miraculous, leave it out. And so he's really challenging the dogmatism of anti-miraculous, or I might even say anti-wondrous narrative in biblical texts. I mean, okay, so Lewis would agree with this. What if coincidences happen? Or what if prayer does get answered sometime? Or Jesus with Marcus Borg and the Jesus Seminar. Jesus was probably a healing person, or maybe a shaman, or somebody who had spiritual power. Are we going to say there were no healers, no exorcists in the ancient world? Of course not. So Jesus would have been interpreted like that, but also within the Jewish prophets, and this was significant. His signs were significant, saying that he has spiritual power, however that's understood. If somebody's going to deny the resurrection, well, go ahead. But early Christians, their lives were changed. Okay, now that is a critical problem, but also people were willing to suffer and die for what they had encountered or what they believed. So Lewis would agree that these are critical problems with dogmatic naturalism. And one of the mistakes of New Testament scholars is to try to explain away everything that's wondrous, saying it must have come from mythology. It can't come from history. Now, I would also be happy to go with anything in the Gospels as rooted in fairy tales or mythology. But the fact is, the wonders in the Gospels is more like other Gospel narratives than it is like Greco-Roman mythologies. And so there's something that is coherent there that's significant. The fourth bleat is that in saying everything goes back to folkloric origins, and there he's going to quote David Strauss, The Life of Jesus Critically Examined, and his second book, The Christ of Faith and the Jesus of History. Actually, it's Versus the Jesus of History. saying, in all of my works, I've done everything I can to show that Schleiermacher was wrong, because Schleiermacher argued that John is the one gospel that goes back to historical memory of Jesus, firsthand memory of Jesus, because of its nuance and its insights along the way. So Lewis would be saying that scholars today misinterpret even his own writings. Like he had this view of Aslan or somebody else in the light of the atomic bomb or something like that. And he said, no, this is written before the atomic bomb. Mm-hmm. And so if they're wrong about me, how can they claim to be wrong about people who can't defend themselves? So in that sense, he really is jumping in to a critique of the larger enterprise. And I think, and Tom Wright would agree with this, I think we need to be more humble about what we negate about a first century author. Hmm. You know, at least they thought this. Now, why did they think that? And what's the strength and weakness of that view?
And do we know why Lewis felt so compelled to address this topic when, as you've already said, this was clearly not his area of expertise?
The way that he describes it, he's going to be speaking, and he notes that there is an article on the desk of a theologian, and he picks it up and reads it and says, oh my goodness, this scholar is claiming this and whatever, whatever. And so he really is raising a question for divinity lecturers. Are we doing people preparing for ministry a service by not thinking about the sheep, just seeing shepherds trying to convince other shepherds that what the sheep think is totally wrong? And so he really is concerned about theological education, but in that sense, the larger picture as well.
And as a Johannine scholar yourself, do you ever personally engage with critiques from outside the field, such as those presented by Lewis, when you're studying and teaching the Bible?
Well, I engage primarily among other scholars. Mm-hmm. But as editor of Quaker Religious Thought a few years ago, we did an issue on theism and non-theism. And so, you know, happy to hear different perspectives, both for and against. My introductory essay in that volume was that sometimes non-theist scholars are pretty ignorant about theology. And so go ahead. And so I would ask them, okay, which particular aspect of theism do you disagree with? And I might agree with you. but are you going to really throw out 2,000 years or maybe even 3,000, including Jewish scholarship, just because you don't agree with one, you know, elementary understanding of something? I'm also a peace scholar as a Quaker scholar, and so I've argued against violence going back to Jesus. I also gave a 16,000-word essay to Pope Benedict and to Cardinal Casper in 2006 on a new vision of Christian unity for the church, arguing that being one in following Jesus, hoping to discern, attend, and follow Jesus together, that would be a new vision of Christian unity. So I'm following Raymond Brown's work there at trying to make contributions within church leadership and those kinds of things.
The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
We're going to take a quick break now, but if you are enjoying today's show, please do consider rating it and leaving a review on your podcast platform so that other people can discover it too.
Have you ever wondered if angel stories are real or just religious folklore? This month, Premier Insight is offering a fascinating ebook called The Case for Angels: Evidence, Encounters, and Scripture. It examines real-life testimonies, biblical insight, and reasoned arguments for the reality of angels today. If you're curious about the supernatural or how to talk about it with skeptics, this resource is for you. It's yours today as a thank you for your gift to Premier Insight. Get your copy now at premierinsight.org/C.S. Lewis. That's premierinsight.org/C.S. Lewis to receive your ebook today. Thank you.
The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
Welcome back to the show. We would love to hear your thoughts and ideas. Do get in touch on social media at Premier Unbelievable. Now let's return to the conversation. Paul, the title for this essay is rather bizarre, isn't it? Fern Seeds and Elephants. Do we have any idea what the title means, where it came from?
Yes. Simply, scholars are too picky in looking at the fern seed, the small itemized little problems, and missing the elephant in the room. So the fern seed would be, you know, particular idiosyncrasies in the text. Therefore, it can't be historical, because we know that, because we're real scholars. When the elephant in the room is that somebody is saying in the Gospel of John, this is written by an eyewitness. He actually saw the blood and water come out of the side of Jesus. Now, just a point on that insight of John 19:34 and 35. It's not claiming that we know that he was divine. It's claiming we really know that he suffered and died, that he was really human. So that's pushing back against people in the Johannine situation, like 1 John 4:1-3. The antichrists or the false prophets are teaching Jesus did not suffer. He did not come in the flesh. And so they're saying, no, he did suffer. He did come in the flesh. Now, what I might guess is going on there, which is probably in the 80s and 90s, is that Gentile believers in Jesus, they're not Gnostics yet, they're just docetists, dokeo, seem, appear. Jesus wasn't really human, he just seemed to be human, that they are saying it's okay to worship Caesar, to say pledge allegiance to the flag, God save the queen, or something like that, or king, sorry.
King, yeah.
That they're willing to go along with imperial cult under Domitian, 81-96, if they don't, they might suffer and die. And so the conservatives or the more Jewish followers in Jesus say, no, Jesus really suffered and died. And they would say, no, he didn't. He was God. God can't suffer. Gotcha. So it's okay to offer incense to Caesar. And so here we have the eyewitness testifying he really did suffer and die. And therefore, you must be willing to ingest the flesh and blood of Jesus. You must be willing to suffer and die with him if you expect to be raised up in the afterlife. And so those are some of the ways that the text is speaking to audiences back then, which also speak to us existentially today about our faithfulness to the gospel.
And Paul, you mentioned those four bleats that Lewis had took issue with the biblical scholars of the day. I mean, how valid do you think some of his critiques are of biblical criticism, in your opinion, as a scholar?
I think they're pretty fair. Again, he's not dealing with particular claims. And so that's these are general impressions, which are somewhat overblown, because not all critical scholars think that, or scholars are also critical of those views as well. So these are just general concerns, but I think that they do represent, again, in the late 1950s and also after that, ways that New Testament scholars in Britain simply go along with a critical view without criticizing the view. What I'm calling for in my introduction to the New Testament, From Crisis to Christ, I'm calling for second criticality. It's not just second naivete, like you have innocent view, criticism, and then recovery of innocence, even though the critics are always right. As a critical scholar, we disagree with each other. I think we therefore have to criticize criticism as well as tradition. And I think Lewis would agree with me on that.
And how do you think Lewis's thoughts in this essay might be received by other biblical scholars today?
Yeah, well, thank you. My friend Richard Bauckham has written a response to it, as well as several others. Bauckham, I think, is rightly critical of Lewis's naivete or his lack of familiarity with that which he's criticizing. And I would agree with that. On the other hand, I think Richard would agree with me about the overall gist of Lewis's critique. And also Tom Wright, I've talked with him about it, and he has his own views about, you know, the macro approach to how we think about the New Testament. And so Tom would agree with me also on those things.
And you've mentioned Bultmann at various points in this, and obviously you're a Bultmann scholar. Lewis refers a little bit to Bultmann in this essay. Would you just take us back a little bit? I mean, who was Rudolf Bultmann, and do we know how Lewis would have encountered his work at all?
Well, I think Lewis and Bultmann would have agreed on one of the points, and this is also in my presentation that I made, that the whole point is how does it speak to us existentially today? Lewis would agree with Bultmann that it's the existential impact of the text as opposed to where it really came from. That's the important thing. And so I think we would all agree on that. And so the question is how to read the text meaningfully. But Lewis is not aware of the great extent and profundity of Bultmann's work. And so Bultmann also, as a pastor and son of a pastor, is dealing with the very problem of miracles. If you look at Bultmann's book on sermons, he's really dealing with the fact. What do you do when German Christians are praying during World Wars I and II and entire communities and families get decimated and war is tragic? And so Bultmann also is dealing existentially with the problem of pain, and they would have a lot of overlap there in those concerns. I have also written and said and believe that Bultmann's commentary on John is perhaps the most important New Testament work in the entire 20th century. And I've also published it in my series with Alan Culpepper, the Johannine Monograph series. And I wrote an 8,000-word introduction to his commentary. So I think it's extremely important, even though I disagree with a lot of it. Now, why is it important? Because Bultmann is so theologically astute. He notices tensions and he notices problems. Sometimes he throws them into greater relief than they deserve to be, but Bultmann is absolutely brilliant. And he was also an amazing linguist. And so he would show connections with this and that and make possible bridges, which are interesting, but not necessarily compelling. Like, because we have this theme in the Gospel of John and third or fourth century Gnosticism, that therefore John the Baptist must have been a Gnostic and that his followers might have been Gnostics and that they included Gnostic I am sayings in their memory of Jesus. So that stuff did not go back to Jesus, it went back to Gnostic poetry, and therefore it's not Jesus, it's early Gnosticism. Well, I do not think that the origin of that is Gnosticism. I think it contributes to later Gnostic views, but we certainly do have the evangelist expanding upon his memory of Jesus, and even if he was a follower of John the Baptist. And so you have, like in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, you have a parable of the shepherd and the sheep. Well, John just expands that in a Christological, Christocentric way. Yeah, and Jesus is the good shepherd. Or you have Jesus feeding people in the synoptics. And by the way, Jesus is the bread of life. And so I see that as, you know, paraphrastic appropriations of memory. And I will say that that's probably the evangelist's teaching about Jesus rather than quotations of Jesus. Although in Matthew, Jesus says, you're the light of the world. And John says, I'm the light of the world. So in Matthew, Jesus says, you're the light of the world. In John, Jesus says, I'm the light of the world. So you can't say on the basis of the synoptics, Jesus never said light of the world. But we do have a Johannine appropriation in a Christocentric way. And maybe that's the way John just does history in a theologically embellished way.
Paul, do we know how Lewis would have encountered Boltmann? Because obviously he was an English scholar. He wouldn't have been reading theologians left, right, and center, would he?
No. And he also, in his references, in this particular essay, he's addressing his theology of the New Testament, not his Gospel of John. And the English translation of the Gospel of John was not translated into English until 1971. And so Lewis would not have known his Gospel of John, where Boltmann goes into more of a basis for some of his views.
He mentions Boltmann specifically in this essay. I'm aware that you said he's not necessarily addressing particular theologians, but are there any other people that he mentions in this essay or any other ideas of specific theologians that Lewis addresses in this essay?
Not so much general tendencies, but also these general tendencies are sometimes emblemized in the authoritative work of Boltmann. And so I think the Boltmann, again, is the leading New Testament scholar, certainly in the early to middle 20th century. And so sometimes a British scholar will say, as Boltmann and the critics will say, and then just appeal to Boltmann as an unassailable authority.
Thank you for listening to the C.S. Lewis podcast with me, Ruth Jackson. Many of the topics that we've touched on today are discussed in greater detail on earlier episodes of the programme. Check out our archive of past shows at premierunbelievable.com, where you can also find lots of great articles, videos and podcasts. Plus, if you register on our website or sign up for our newsletter there, then you will get exclusive access to new content, free resources and more. That's premierunbelievable.com. What did you think of today's show? Are there any topics or works of C.S. Lewis that you would like us to explore next? We would love to hear from you. Send us an email, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Connect with us on X, formerly known as Twitter, @premierunbelievablefe, or drop us a direct message on Instagram or Facebook @premierunbelievable. We have also recently launched on TikTok, so if that's your thing, or you know anyone else who might be interested, then you can find us there @premier.unbelievable. Your feedback and thoughts are so important to us, so please get in touch. If you're enjoying the C.S. Lewis podcast, please do consider rating and reviewing it on whatever platform you're listening on, as it helps more people to discover the show. Thank you for listening and see you next time.
Mornings can start feeling the same. Wake up, brush teeth, go to work. But with breakfast from Wendy's, it's like, wake up, brush teeth, baconate with a breakfast baconator, roll with the sausage breakfast burrito, buddy it up with a honey buddy, or get seasoned with seasoned potatoes, and then go to work. Sorry. When you're ready for a fresh wake-up call, gotta be Wendy's.
At participating U.S. Wendy's during breakfast hours.